Tonight on Arena, American elections on TV and film, and Paula Meehan on The Historians, the final collection from Evan Boland. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And great to be back with you on this Monday evening. Thanks very much to Kate for holding the fort for the last week. Chances are that many of you listening this evening, in fact, are getting set to pull an all-nighter tomorrow with that most exhilarating of spectator blood sports taking place in the wee small hours, an American general election. It's a treat we get to gorge on every 4 years from our very own sofas, or perhaps from behind the sofa, as the case may be. Naturally enough, American elections have featured prominently in the cinema and television that has come out of that country in recent decades. And here to peruse the best of the bunch are Lise Hand and Justin McGregor. Definitely an all-nighter on the part of you, Lise Hand, I'm guessing.
Absolutely, have the beers in, popcorn at the ready. It's kind of the political geek Super Bowl, except it's every 4 years.
Yeah, I did hear somebody talking about beers earlier on the television as well. I'm not quite sure if I'll manage that first for the 7 o'clock rise. What about you, Justin? You'll be doing the all-nighter, I guess, as well.
Yes, and leaving up the Halloween ornaments just in case.
Which would be your excuse for going behind the sofa.
Exactly.
All right, I suppose we have to, Justin, start. If we're going to start with television, there's really only one place to start. Not just with American elections, but I suppose American politics in general. The West Wing, first aired in 1999. Bill Clinton was in office at the time. What kind of White House does Aaron Sorkin give us in The West Wing, and why can't we have one?
I think that's a question people still ask. I mean, it's a very earnest White House of people who really want to do good, who are drawn to the power of government to be a place people can come to do positive change. You know, in President Bartlet, they've got someone who's compassionate, decisive, you know, loves his wife, and happens to have a Nobel Prize in economics, which isn't bad for your for your president. And he portrays them really trying to sort of fight a complicated system, and does, to be fair, sometimes give some really great roles and points of view to Republican politicians as well, which was sort of one of the things that really stood out about it for the 7 years it was on.
But was there something in particular, Lise, about the Bill Clinton era that gave birth to the West Wing, or was it coming out of somewhere else, do you think?
I think it probably was. I mean, it's interesting that, you know, it started in the Bill Clinton era and ended in the George Bush, and to a certain extent possibly presaged the arrival of Barack Obama as well. Mm. You know, with the character in the last series,
Jimmy Santos.
I keep getting names mixed up. So, you know, it was sort of the White House under the Clintons was sort of chaotic. And you know, there's certainly stories of, you know, even St. Patrick's Day in the White House, you know, there was just like paddies everywhere, you know, just like getting pissed. And, you know, the whole place was, you know, just, you know, chaos and friendliness and so on. And then you had this backdrop of chaos about obviously then the whole Lewinsky scandals and Whitewater scandals and every class of scandal. So, you know, it was quite a chaotic time. But, you know, then the White House created this sort of, you know, calm, much more calm and controlled. Yes, there were scandals and so on, but it was kind of, you know, the sort of fantasy White House, really.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the Santos election there. I'll play that clip actually right now because it doesn't feature President Bartlet, because this is Matt Santos. Jimmy Smith is the character, isn't he? Matt Santos is the character that he's playing here.
Yeah, he actually was based on, one of the main writers of that series, you know, did actually grill one of then Senator Obama's staffers, you know, asking about him. So, you know, there is actually, you know.
Yeah, there are parallels there. I suppose what they went with Santos, they went with a Latino candidate rather than Barack Obama's ethnicity. But let's have a listen here to Santos making a campaign speech.
We must know that we have made some progress, and blame will only destroy it. Blame will breed more violence, and we have had enough of that. Blame will not rid our streets of crime and drugs and fear, and we have had enough of that. Blame will not strengthen our schools or our families or our workforce. Blame will rob us of those things, and we have had enough of that. And so I ask you today to dig down deep with me and find that compassion in your heart, because it will keep us on the road. and we will walk together and work together. And slowly, slowly, too slowly, things will get better. God bless you. God bless you, and God bless your children.
Thought we were going to get God Bless America, surely, at the end of that. Matt Santos, their character played by Jimmy Smits in The West Wing. Lee's Hand and Justin McGregor are with me this evening looking at fictional American elections and fictional American representations of American politics. I was saying to you, Lee's, as we were listening to that, it was a very even-handed series. There were good Republicans, bad Republicans, good Democrats and bad Democrats.
I mean, absolutely. And it had fans, you know, on both sides of the divide on Capitol Hill as well. When you, you know, you look at people who actually liked it. Yeah. I mean, Karl Rove, you know, who was sort of the ultimate neocon, he was a fan of it. And, you know, he was often said it was quite realistic. And, you know, no less than three former presidents all said, no, actually, the way it's done is quite realistic. I mean, Gerald Ford liked it. Bill Clinton obviously liked it. And Barack Obama liked it. So, you know, there was this, you know, and then you had this, you know, you had a president who was, you know, kind of fuzzy and liberal in some ways. But then he was very hawkish when it came to foreign affairs,
policies,
much more
policies,
much more hawkish actually than say Bill Clinton ever was. And then you obviously had the character in the last series played by Alan Alda, Arnie Vinnick, who was the Republican candidate, and he was actually quite like John McCain, who obviously ran against Barack Obama as well. They were both sort of, you know, maverick and kind of did their own thing. So while it was, the sort of every Democrat loved it, I mean, it had its fans among the Republicans as well.
It would be wrong of us not to have a clip of Bartlett played by Martin Sheen. And in fact, this is one that you pointed us in the direction of, Justin, and it has such relevances to very recent debates in America, particularly around the Supreme Court.
Yes, no, there was an episode in season 5 called The Supremes about Glenn Close played a liberal lion, Evelyn Baker Lang, and they really wanted her to get on the court, but they knew they could never get her through the, you know, through Congress, through the Senate approval process. So they were putting up a safe middle of the road candidate. And at the end of the day, they realized, well, wait, why don't we give the Republicans one and we'll take one? And again, this sort of idea that, you know, there are noble Republicans, they actually nominate a really intellectual, small government professor type as their young candidate to go against their liberal lion.
Well, let's listen to Christopher Mulready. This is the William Fisher playing the character here, discussing with the aforementioned President Bartlett, played by Martin Sheen, about the different choices that the President has for the Supreme Court.
Who's at the top of the list? If I leaked it, would they believe me?
Brad Shelton.
Really?
You don't like him?
He's a fine jurist. And in the event that Carmine, Lafayette, Hoyt, Clark and Brannigan all drop dead, the center will still be well tended.
You want another Brady?
Sure. Just like you'd like another Ashland. Who wouldn't? The court was at its best when Brady was fighting Ashland.
I need a good law written by the voices of moderation.
Who writes the extraordinary dissent? The one man minority opinion whose time hasn't come, but 20 years later, some circuit court clerk digs it up at 3 a.m. Brennan railing against censorship. Harlan's Jeremiah out on Jim Crow.
Maybe you someday.
They can't put me on the court. Just like you can't put Evelyn Lang on the court. It's Shelton's from here on in.
There are 4,000 protesters outside this building worried about who's going to land in that seat. We can't afford to alienate all of them.
We all have our roles to play, sir. Yours is to nominate someone who doesn't alienate people.
There you go. William Fichter and Martin Sheen in the scene from The West Wing. We could talk about The West Wing for the next half hour, but that would not be fair to the other people that we are, the other series that we want to speak about as well. And again, this is kind of, it would strike me, Lise, this is the first one that would jump up for most people, All the President's Men. And you're talking about the film here very clearly because you weren't that fond of the book.
No, I mean, the book, I mean, as a journalist, of course, I love the book. But it's a process book. You know, it's two guys who go very deeply into the weeds in the book about, and then this happened and then that happened. You know, it's relatively turgid. And also, they were still him and hawing about even writing the book when they actually got nudged along by Robert Redford, who came to them, who had, you know, followed the story avidly, and who came to them and said, lads, will you write a book because I want to option film rights? So, you know, I suspect the two boys just sat down and kind of horsed it out in order really to get the film rights as much as anything else. You know, so the book, yes, as a journalist, it's fascinating. But, you know, the film is, it's just perfect. It's actually perfect.
And you said, Justin, in fact, that part of what makes the film perfect is that it's almost like a psychological thriller rather than a process, which is not thrilling at all to watch.
No, exactly. I mean, they took that element of the work that they were doing and they turned it into a film in a way that a lot of adaptations don't get right. They made it this tense thriller, even though you know the outcome. You know what's going to happen at the end, but when they're in, you know, in the garage talking to Deep Throat, just the feeling, every car door that slams, every squeaking wheel, you think someone's going to come and knock them off. And they build this tension so brilliantly with these wide shots and with the phone calls to each other. It's just amazing how they make it a murder mystery where we actually know who did it.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, this clip that I have gives a sense of that tension. Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford, who else? Bernstein and Woodward. And Ben Bradley, the editor of the Washington Post at the time, played by Jason Robards. And the two reporters are trying to convince the editor, you got to tweet this story because people are going to die if you don't.
We've all been
people's
there.
Lives are in danger. Maybe even ours.
What happened to that justice source of yours?
Well, I guess I made the instructions too complicated because he thought I said hang up when I just said hang on.
Oh, Jesus.
The story is right.
Alderman was the fifth name to control that fund, and Sloan would have told the grand jury.
Sloan wanted to tell the grand jury.
Why didn't he?
Because nobody asked him. The cover-up had little to do with the break-in. It was to protect covert operations. The covert activities involved the entire U.S. intelligence community.
Did Deep Throat say that people's lives are in danger?
Yes.
What else did he say?
He said everyone is involved.
You know the results of the latest Gallup poll? Half the country never even heard of the word Watergate. Nobody gives a shit. You guys are probably pretty tired, right? Well, you should be. Go on home. Get a nice hot bath. Rest up 15 minutes. Then get your asses back in gear. We're under a lot of pressure, you know, and you put us there. Nothing's riding on this except the First Amendment of the Constitution. Freedom of the press, and maybe the future of the country.
So nothing to worry about then. Jason Robards as Ben Bradley there, and Dustin Hoffman and Robert Redford as Bernstein and Woodward, respectively. Liz, ever had an editor like Ben Bradley or like Jason Robards, perhaps, with a voice like Jason Robards?
With the voice, I wouldn't mind. I mean, I've had a few of those scenes where, you know, you got to run the story, you know, please, and it's torn apart in front of your very eyes. Yeah, I mean, that's happened to me before. But, you know, Jason Robards was absolutely magnificent. You know, apparently... you know, when he went into the Washington Post to kind of get the feel of the newsroom and so on, Ben Bradley only had one instruction for him and said, just don't make me look like an asshole, which was, I thought, was absolutely, you know, it was wonderful. And, you know, apparently, and you know something as well, it's one of the very few movies that absolutely and utterly gets a newsroom right. And the lengths they went to, they literally rebuilt the newsroom using the same desks as the Washington Post. They painted them same colours. They got all the trash cans and they, you know, from the newsroom and put them around the room. I mean, there's a real authenticness to this, you know, and it's just, you know, and I suppose the great thing as well is that the American president, you never see him except in newsreels. So it's this menacing kind of presence in the back while these two guys are going about their work.
And obviously all around the time of Nixon. So that kind of was
the paranoia and everything. Yeah. Fantastic.
Robert Redford in a very different, not quite the saviour of the world in the candidate, Justin McGregor.
No, he plays plays a California lawyer who's always fighting the good fight, and he gets plucked out to run against an unbeatable Republican senator because Robert Redford's playing a Democrat, and he happens to be the son of a former governor, so he's got some name recognition. And as he begins to run, his poll numbers get worse and worse and worse, and he starts to sell out his message, and the more he sells it out and the more meaningless his words become, the higher he starts to go up in the poll, until he ends up saying almost nothing and in a dead heat with the senator he's up against.
All right, let's listen to him in the process of selling out then. Bill McKay, played by Robert Redford, from The Candidate.
In the beginning, I think it's important to note what subjects we haven't discussed. We've completely ignored the fact that this is a society divided by fear, hatred, and violence. And until we talk about just what this society really is, then I don't know how we're going to change it. For example, we haven't discussed the rot that destroys our cities. We have all the resources we need to check it, and we don't use them. And we haven't discussed why not. We haven't discussed race in this country. We haven't discussed poverty. In short, we haven't discussed any of the sicknesses that may yet send this country up in flames. And we better do it. We'd better get it out in the open and confront it before it's too late.
There you go. Robert Redford as Bill McKay. I think we heard Don Porter in there as Crocker Jarman. Actually, I think he's still reasonably okay in that scene, if I'm understanding the clip right. He hasn't quite sold out.
No.
He hasn't quite sold out just yet. You know, part of what I noticed about a lot of the screenwriters in various parts here, Lise, is that they had a background. We mentioned it about the Santos character and the West Wing. Yeah. You were in, was it New York in 2008?
Yeah, I covered the Democratic National Convention when Barack Obama was, you know, officially given the nomination. It was in Denver, and I covered some of the campaign trail as well, you know, in leading up to the election. But we're going to talk about Game Change, obviously, which is an amazing book. It's just a brilliant book. It's such a gossipy book. It's wonderful.
And whose story are we hearing in Game Change?
Game Change is basically written by two journalists, and it follows that campaign. And, you know, there's sections of the book, and there one section is on the Obama campaign, one is on the John Edwards campaign, one is on the Hillary Clinton campaign, and then one is on the John McCain stroke Sarah Palin campaign. And the Sarah Palin stuff is jaw-dropping. And, you know, she was the story of the campaign. Now, just to give you an idea of just how extraordinary, you know, her appearance was, the morning after the nomination of Barack Obama, of course, all the Washington press corps were there, all the heavyweights, all the editors, all the big guns. And everybody was on the same flight from Denver back to New York. Everybody was on. It was one flight. It was the early flight. Everybody was on, you know, everybody tense and sort of, you know, sitting on the plane, and people were filing copy and so on. It was just journalists. Anyway, we're just settling into cruising altitude. And, you know, it's a long enough flight, you know, 4.5 hours, whatever. And the pilot, God love him, comes on and says, and now, you know, remember, this is before there was anything like phones on a plane. And he goes, you know, hi, we're cruising at blah, blah, blah. We'll be landing and blah, blah, blah. And just for anybody who's interested, Senator John McCain has just announced his running mate, and it's Sarah Palin. Now, there was complete silence on the plane for about 10 seconds.
Was there silence like you just gave me there?
Yeah, there was like literally a stunned silence. And then all hell broke loose. I mean, people were literally, there were editors running up and down the aisles going, who is Sarah Palin? We need to know something. And now they're stuck in the belly of the Iron Chicken, you know, 35,000 feet in the air with no information and 4-hour flight. It was absolutely extraordinary because, you know, everybody was trying to sort of pool their knowledge because she was a bolt out of the blue. Nobody knew her. She was from Alaska and, you know, no, people had zero information. So, you know, it completely electrified that campaign and just changed the whole course of it.
And Julianne Moore plays Sarah Palin in the film. An amazing performance, Justin, you're saying about her, about this from Julianne Moore.
Oh no, there are times you think you're watching Sarah Palin play herself. Like, it is absolutely uncanny. I mean, much better than Tina Fey on Saturday Night Live. But she also makes her sympathetic. Like, this person who does get thrown in the deep end, she thinks if they've chosen her, she must be fine, doesn't realise what she doesn't know. I mean, she thinks America has good relations with the Queen. You know, not the British government. She doesn't know there's a prime minister. I mean, it's really remarkable, you know, the gaffes. But you do start to really begin to sort of feel, as John McCain did, for this woman who they plucked out of nowhere, and nobody had asked her policy questions. Nobody had asked her what she knew. They just knew she'd be popular. She had 80% approval rating in Alaska, which is insane, off the charts. And she did. She brought them back to even until she started talking.
Yeah. I wonder how Steve Schmidt, I wonder how sympathetic he felt towards her. He was her campaign manager, played by Woody Harrelson in the movie. And in this clip, he's trying to explain to her what actually happened with one of her children. Todd is one of her children, isn't he? Yes. Yeah, let's have a listen. Julianne Moore as Sarah Palin and Woody Harrelson as Steve Schmidt.
You can't say you were cleared of all wrongdoing.
Why not?
Because you weren't. The report stated that you abused your power. That is the opposite of being cleared of all wrongdoing.
Then why was I told otherwise?
You weren't told otherwise.
And why haven't you released a statement saying that Todd was never a member of the Alaska Independence Party?
Because that would be untrue. He was a member.
He checked the wrong box. He registered by accident and rectified the error immediately.
He was a member for 7 years. I'm sorry, Governor, but There is only a few weeks left in this campaign. You have got to stop saying things to the press that are blatantly untrue. That is not the kind of campaign that we are running here.
Campaign? Is that what you're calling this, you know?
Governor, I admit that this is a dysfunctional campaign, but that is what I inherited, and I'm doing my level best to help us win this election.
And that's what I'm trying to do too, Stephen. All you're doing is screwing me up. That's all you've done this entire time is get in my way. Oh, and I am raising millions of dollars for this campaign. Hundreds of thousands of people are coming to see me speak, not John McCain, God bless him. They are coming to see me. So if I am single-handedly carrying this campaign, I'm going to do what I want.
Wow. Would you like to be managing that campaign? Stephen Smith. She does that motherly thing of, yeah. She calls him Stephen. He knows he's in trouble. Woody Harrelson there. And Julianne Moore playing Sarah Powell. If you could take your eyebrows down from the ceiling and your chin up from the ground at this stage, you really were. You just threw your eyes to heaven when you listened to that. Very like the sort of thing that we heard in reality, Lise.
It was. She was... the role was played to perfection. Julianne Moore was stunning. Mm. But, you know, when I kind of watched it, and you watch it, I suppose, with the hindsight as well of, you know, knowing where we are now, really, and I saw this on the ground and I went to a few of the Palin rallies as well. Really what we saw there was sort of the birth of, you know, the whole Tea Party movement, mm-hmm. which took the GOP to the right. And that, of course, spawned Trumpism. And, you know, you can sort of see in some of Sarah Palin's, her pronouncements, her kind of, you know, vague kind of, you know, connections with reality and the truth, the sort of beginnings of what, you know, really did become the sort of Donald Trump shtick. Yeah.
She called them she was referring to mistruths as opposed to fake news.
Yeah. But you know, that's really where it began.
Todd is her husband, by the way, which I think you were saying to me as well. You thought it was the husband. Yes, Todd is the husband, or it was the husband of Sarah Palin, not a child, as I was suggesting. I'll have to choose one more. Let's go to one that's not about Bill Clinton, called Primary Colours.
This is absolutely not about Bill Clinton. Primary Colours, again, we're talking about a book, you know, that's, you know, written by Anonymous, a lot of Anonymous around these days, but written by Anonymous, who was, you know, shortly after the book came out in 1996, was unmasked as political columnist Joe Klein, and it was not based on the Clinton presidential campaign of 1992, and it was not about Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton dealing with sort of bimbo eruptions, and it was not told to the eyes of George Stephanopoulos at all.
All right, well, let me ask Justin then to tell me, what was it about, since it wasn't about any of those things?
Well, it was inspired by them. I mean, it was a Roman Eclef, so a work of fiction that's based on real people and events, but, I mean, obviously it was cutting incredibly close to, you know, almost unpublishable things that were really going on, but maybe that couldn't be verified, you know, to the standards of journalism. And the book, caused a huge sensation. And 9 months, I think, they hunted for Anonymous before Joe Klein. I think he accidentally, there was a chapter they found with had some notes on it, and they hired an expert to match the handwriting to everyone covering the campaign. Like, that's how much they wanted Joe to find out who it was.
Yeah, well, here's John Travolta as Governor Jack Stanton, not sounding like Bill Clinton at all.
And I don't have to tell you how hard it is to be looking for work. Hey, I don't have to tell you anything about hard times. So you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to do something really outrageous. I'm going to tell the truth. I know what you're thinking. You're thinking he must really be desperate to do that. But if you had to swallow enough garbage.
You can say shit. We're X-rated.
me too, if you believe what you read in the paper. Okay. All right. Here's the truth. No politician can reopen this factory or bring back the shipyard jobs or make your union strong again. No politician can make it be the way it used to be. Because we're living in a new world now, a world without economic borders. A guy can push a button in New York and move $1 billion to Tokyo in the blink of an eye. And in that world, muscle jobs go where muscle labor is cheap, and that is not here. So if you want to compete, you're going to have to exercise a different set of muscles, the one between your ears.
There you go. John Travolta as Governor Jack Staunton in a scene there from Primary Colours. Thanks so much to Lise Hand and Justin McGregor for their thoughts around fictional American presidential elections. Home you go now, straight to bed early tonight because you're going to be up all night tomorrow night.
Absolutely.
I might even stay up a bit myself. Evan Boland's sudden death in April this year came as an enormous shock to everyone, but it turns out she left us one last gift. A new poetry collection due to be published next week by Carcanet Press. The Historians takes up many of Boland's regular themes, myth and history, the lives of women, including her own family, and the power and the limits of poetry. Paula Mahon has been reading the collection for us, and she joins us now. Maybe we could start, Paula, with the opening poem in the collection, which I have to say really stopped me in my tracks when I read it over the weekend. Do you want to introduce the Fire Gilder for us, or will you just go straight into reading it? Well, give us an introduction.
I'll introduce it. It concerns her mother's legacy. Her mother was an artist, Frances Kelly, studied in Paris, came back and married her father, Freddie Boland, who was really one of the architects of the early republic. He negotiated our way out of Commonwealth and into republic. And he was an early ambassador at the court of St. James after the war and in the UN, the permanent mission to the UN later on. But Ivan's mother is given to us in many earlier poems as an artist. And she encouraged and nurtured Ivan's own artistic aspirations visually and then later as a poet. But it also has that underlying, which all of Ivan's work has, an underlying kind of frisson of warning. And it's about her mother telling her about a very dangerous process in visual art, the gilding. So that's basically the introduction to it, the Fire Gilder. She loved silver. She loved gold, my mother. She spoke about the influence of metals, the congruence of atoms, the art classes where she learned these things. Think of it, she would say, as she told me, to gild any surface, a master craftsman had to meld gold with mercury, had to heat both so one was volatile, one was not, and to do it right, had to separate them and then burn mercury until it fled and left behind a skin of light. The only thing, she added, but what came after that, I forgot. What she spent a lifetime forgetting could be my subject, the fenced-in small towns of Leinster, the coastal villages where the language of the sea was handed on, phrases bruised by storms, by shipwrecks, but isn't. My subject is the part wishing plays in the way villages are made to vanish, in the way I learned to separate memory from knowledge so one was volatile, one was not, and how I started writing, burning light, building heat, until all at once I was the Fire Gilder, ready to lay radiance down, ready to decorate it happened with it never did, when all at once I remember what it was she said. The only thing is, it is extremely dangerous.
Paula Mahon reading Evan Boland's poem there, The Fire Gilder, first poem in the new collection, The Historians, from Evan Boland, obviously, who died in April, and we're getting this collection next week. In fact, it's that final, those final two lines, Paula, when she remembers what it was her mother said, the only thing is, it is extremely dangerous. How dangerous a medium was poetry in the hands of a master craftsman like Evan Boland?
Well, it was powerful, ferocious, and it earned her a worldwide reputation. It earned her a number of prestigious chairs in Stanford University. It earned her the respect and devotion of her graduate students. It earned her the love and companionship of a generation of Irish poets of all genders and none. Mm. And it really did open pathways into discussing what it was like to be a citizen of a post-colonial country. So it has influence and power right beyond this small island, into India, into Australia, into everywhere there's been colony and there's been the arguments where language and colony clash and meet. And I suppose her big adventure was to use one to try and heal the wounds of the other. And this last collection, which, by the way, is a very good starting place for anybody who's coming new to her work. This last collection really is the summation and the epitome of all of her dangerous activity over the years.
And the other thing that struck me reading through several of the poems, Paula, was the directness of the language. You don't need to have a thesaurus beside you. You will not need to have a classical reference books beside you. This poetry speaks directly to you.
Oh, completely. I suppose, like all poems, it's you will find in them what you put into them. So they do repay many readings. But you're right. I mean, she went for what she called in an earlier poem a civil tongue. And she distrusted ornament for the sake of ornamentation. I mean, that was one of her other subjects throughout her poetry, her making, that, you know, as ornamenters, the artists could often be wasting, as she said herself, their sweetness on the received emblems instead of the truth. So she distrusted, you know, ornamentation for its own sake. And her journey was to really dig in and get at the truth, no matter how unpalatable it was.
And another of the poems gives us a perfect example of that, Eviction, which I think you would say speaks directly to many of the concerns that were there right across her poetic output.
Yeah, and this again is one of the poems that come through, if you like, the matrilinear line through her mother's mother, her grandmother, who was evicted in 1904 from her house in Drogheda. And this part of Ivan's, the mother line seems to have been quite occluded to Ivan's own knowledge. And in fact, it was her great biographer and friend, Jodie Allen Randolph, who, digging down into the archives, unearthed many of the stories of the mother's line. The father's line was more accessible in the written histories because he was of an illustrious family. His father had been a senior civil servant, and his grandfather had been the master of the workhouse in Clonmel. So, but the mother's line was mysterious, and a lot of things weren't spoken about. And her real passion was for these stories that go underground and become hidden, and for complex reasons, don't get passed on. Eviction comes from a small piece in a page of the Drogheda Argus and Leinster Journal for 1904, unearthed by her pal, Jodie Allen Randolph, who is, I call her the super sleuth when it comes to Ivan's life, because she has crawled up into attics and dug down into the archives to bring this information to Ivan herself, who then made amazing work out of it. So, Eviction. Back from Dublin, my grandmother finds an eviction notice on her door. Now she is in court for rent arrears. The lawyers are amused. These are the petty sessions. This is Drogheda. This is the bank holiday. Their comments fill a column in the newspaper. Was the notice well served? Was it served at all? Is she a weekly or a monthly tenant? In which one of the plaintiff's rent books is she registered? The case comes to an end, is dismissed, leaving behind the autumn evening, leaving behind the room she entered, leaving behind the reason I have always resisted history. A woman leaves a courtroom in tears, a nation is rising to the light. History notes the second, not the first, nor does it know the answer as to why on a winter evening in a modern Ireland I linger over the page of the Drogheda Argus and Leinster Journal 1904, knowing as I do that my attention has no agency, none at all, nor my rage. So it's, you can see the she knew, you know, that as a poet, there were also impotencies, if you like, you know, things that the poet cannot do. So there are versions, I suppose, of Auden's poetry makes nothing happen, that as truth tellers, our agency as citizens may not match up to our agency as truth tellers.
And that's that opening section of the book's in five sections, in fact, this new book, the historians being the opening section. It really does deal with a lot of that interface between history and art. The second section in the book is called How We Were Transfigured. And the first poem in that section, in fact, tells us a lot about Sylvia Plath. It's very obvious, I think, pretty immediately for a poet who died young that it's Sylvia Plath that she's speaking about here. How important was Plath to her, would you say, Paula?
Plath was a central poet. In fact, one of the earliest conversations I had with Ivan was about Sylvia Plath, you know, because I would have, she would have been an important poet for me. And what she would always stress when she talked about Plath was the fact that she was a young mother on her own with two small children in an apartment, in a flat, in the coldest winter that England had known since the mid-1700s. She always stressed this, the reality of the life she was trying to live with those two small children. And of course, Ivan would have been a young mother herself when she was first reading and advocating for Plath. But it is a ferocious poem. I mean, it's a heartbreaking poem. I mean, she basically says that whether you live or die, the poetry is left there. And why? And she claims Plath as a serious influence in her own life. Will I read it?
Yes, let's hear the poem to finish up. Thanks, Paula.
For a poet who died young, even now I see myself there, your book propped on the kitchen table. When I closed it, your poems would not stay put. They roamed the house. They saw my children sleeping. They stared out the window. They looked into the sly double vowels of Ursa Major or Lyra. They knew the stars inside were tired of signifying wheat and old beasts. They understood these were once women who wanted earthliness, the sort that understood a circle or the origin of stoneware or a blueness they could never see at night. You died young. Your words helped me live. I was younger then. Your ghost is still young, is still dead. Your words disturbed my earth. They changed my mind. Whatever a dead poet could have, I wish for you. But a living woman is what you should have been. So many years later, forgive the fact my words, unlike yours, offer little comfort and less peace.
Extraordinary. And those words take on a whole new meaning, obviously. Whatever a dead poet could have, I wish for you. But the poems roaming about the house and seeing your sleeping children staring out the window, it's just that those are amazing images. Paula Meehan, this is the crowning a crowning glory to Ivan Boland's output, and somewhere good to start, you would say, if you haven't read Ivan Boland's poetry up to this point.
Yeah, and if you have, and if you like, many of her readers have followed her all along, it's a fantastic lens to take back to the entirety of her life's work and use it as a lens to see where the pathway was leading. It is an absolute magnificent achievement, and it will be launched next week online on the 11th, Wednesday week, by her luminous friends, Colm Tobin, her long-term editor at Carfkinet, Michael Schmidt, our own Maureen Kennelly from the Arts Council, formerly Director of Poetry Ireland. So there'll be a gala celebration of her work.
Great.
And it is a crowning achievement.
That's great. That's Paula Meehan. Thanks for that, Paula. Speaking to us about The Historians by Ivan Boland. And as Paula said to us, it's published by Carcanet. The Bright Side is one of a slew of Irish features which will be premiered at the Cork Film Festival. It runs from this Sunday, November the 8th, through until the following Sunday, November the 15th. And The Bright Side tells the story of a world-weary stand-up comedian, Kate McLaughlin, whose diagnosis with breast cancer changes her perspective on life and her relationships with those around her. The story was inspired by the true life experiences of comedian Anne Gildee, which were detailed in her memoir, I've Got Cancer, What's Your Excuse? The screenplay for the film is co-written by Ruth Meehan and Jean Paisley. Ruth also directed the movie, and Anne Gildee is on the line with me now. We'll get Ruth shortly. Anne, going back to your own memoir, I've Got Cancer, What's Your Excuse? Just bring us back to the time ahead of writing that memoir and what it was you wanted to do in the book.
I really wanted to capture the experience of going through cancer. It was such a novel experience, and at the time, it was 2011, so there wasn't so much social media as there is now. So there wasn't so much out there about the visceral, literal experience of what it's like to go through cancer, go through chemotherapy, mastectomy, all that. So I really wanted to record what that was like. And then as I wrote the book, it kind of broadened out into how the cancer affected my whole life and made me look back on things and the way it just changed the whole perspective. So that was and make it funny.
Well, I was going to say to you, I mean, because obviously it's a very serious topic, but what struck me immediately the film started, I thought, oh, we're going to have fun with this, and then very quickly I thought, oh yeah, and I'm going to be made cry somewhere along the way here as well. It was clear to me that both things were going to happen to me. But what did, in terms of what you were doing in your own stand-up at the time, how much of your experience with the cancer diagnosis and your experience of going through cancer did you use as part of your routines? Because this becomes a vital part and an important part of the character in the film.
Well, you see, that's where there's kind of the film very much parallels the book, but it is not, a replication. It's not me, because my comedy at the time, I started out as a stand-up. I actually began years, it was the late 80s in London. It's quite actually different to anything in the film, really. But I was doing the New Liz at the time, and so that was quite different. And I never referred to the cancer on stage, because our thing with the New Liz was, people are coming for a good night out, and you just keep everything light and happy and fun. But so what I think Ruth was responding to in the book was the emotional truth of the journey and what the character's gone through. So she paralleled it with her own emotional truth and Jean Paisley's emotional truth. And I should tell you herself,
we have Ruth on the line now, so I'll let her tell us about that. Ruth, I was just asking and there about the character of Kate McLaughlin in the book, who is a stand-up comedian, and the impulse here is to say, oh, that's Anne Gildee's experience, but this is a fictional realization in some ways, or a parallel realization of what happened in Anne's book.
Yeah, well, we very deliberately used the book as a jumping off point. Really, I picked it up on my way I've gone off on a break, a much needed break after the death of my own sister, and I picked up Anne's book, and I knew Anne in college, and I was really struck by the kind of the raw, irreverent, and honest portrayal and descriptions she had, and it really kind of touched the nerve with me, because my own sister had a really black sense of humor and a great sense of humor, and you know, I think just as a stand-up who has lost the will to live, but ends up with these four other women in a going on this with this these unsolicited friendships that crack her open. It was really finding that journey for a character who is fictitious, you know. Yeah. But as Anne said, leaning on what was really resonating, that was true for her, in terms of the just dealing with emotional pain and fear and despair, and how we use humor and how we need each other, and these five women, how they come together and, you know, are with great courage and love and crack and kind of hold each other together and crack each other open all at the same time.
Well, let's have a listen to it's Kate is our, I suppose, one of the main characters that brings us through the story here. Gemma Lee Devereaux
is the main character.
Yeah, she's Gemma Lee. Is it Gemma Lee or Gemma Leah, by the way?
Gemma Leah
Devereaux. And here she is doing one of her, Kate McLaughlin, doing one of her stand-up routines, and she clearly is using her cancer diagnosis as material.
So, what does having chemotherapy actually entail? I'm hooked up like a prisoner in a cell with all these other people that I don't know and that I would rather not know. But apparently it's absolutely essential that we stay positive. Speaking of positive, Auntie Eileen sent me a voucher for a treatment of Reiki with the angels. Reiki with the angels. For fuck's sake, 90 bloody euros she paid. Not so smart, my mother's side of the family. Anyway, it was paid for, so I went. And the therapist actually said to me, I sense your cancer has something to do with your unexpressed rage. Shove your Reiki up your gaping chakras, I told her, loud and clear. No problem expressing my rage, me.
Gemma Leah Devereaux there is Kate McLaughlin in the scene from The Bright Side, and director Ruth Meehan is and co-writer Ruth Meehan on the phone with me this evening, and Anne Gildea, whose own memoir was a jumping off point, as we've heard, for the film itself. Really strikes me, and really struck me when there are various points, Ruth, when we see and hear Kate going through those stand-up routines. She uses humour both as a weapon, but really as a big defence mechanism as well, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. And, you know, I mean, we all know how humour can be used to deflect feeling. And it's also, I mean, it's a crutch for better and worse, thank God for it. Mm. And at the same time, this is a character who very much is using it to not feel and to not... And that central relationship with her pain and how that is impacted. But, I mean, these women, they're not going to take... Her strategy is not going to work with them. And, you know, as anybody, and many of us have been through this journey, like, you will meet people from all walks of life, and they are all, you know, they are not going to be, you're not going to be able to get away with things that might normally work. And yet, they work with her and on her, and they become form bonds that are unexpected. And the whole point, I guess, is to just let that work on her and... Yeah. And it eventually destroys all her defences.
Yeah, in fact, that I thought, Anne Gildea, was one of the great, I suppose, to use that word, the journey that the film brings us on, is how Kate has to eventually let the barriers down, and she has to deal with the reality of what was in front of her. And I want to name the other four women: Tracy, the character played by Siobhan Cullen; Roisin, character played by Barbara Brennan; Helen, the character played by Deirdre Crotty; and Fiona, the character played by Karen Egan. I presume, Anne, that when Ruth and Jean were checking in with you, as I think was the way you both put it, about where the story was going and how true it was to your own experience, these women, these type of women, a young woman, an older woman, a gay woman, and a woman in a very difficult marriage who, on the surface, everything is perfect in her life. These women, you met people like this, I presume, in your various journeys.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you met all sorts. What really struck me when I was going through breast cancer treatment was how young the women were. Mm. It was extraordinary. I remember meeting they actually have that scene in the film of doing the makeup tutorial.
Which Anne is in.
Yes, you play the part, Anne.
I play the makeup artist. I remember going, oh, for Jesus' sake, I'm not going to that. And then somebody went, no, but you get a free bag of makeup. So, I went along with it. And they do it in the film. It's wonderful. But I remember meeting a young woman who was only, she was only, I think, 27 years of age, and she'd had a double mastectomy. That's one thing that really struck me, was how young people were. I mean, I was 45 when I got it, and I thought, I'm too young. And then it certainly had become a young woman's disease, and so it's interesting. Gemma Leah and Siobhan found this great bond in the film, and they're the two younger women.
Yeah, Siobhan
really
Cullen,
beautiful.
Who plays the character of Tracy, that's
amazing.
That relationship as well, Ruth, I thought was beautifully observed, both in the writing and in the playing by Gemma Leah and Siobhan Cullen. It is absolutely extraordinary. I'm presuming, without being prurient, that you were mining on your sister's experience for parts of that.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And the thing that I found about working with all of those five women was it was incredible support, I think, that they gave each other and me. And with Jemalia and Siobhan, they were acutely aware of how that relationship was central to the authentic tracking of this character's release of that pain. And they really went for it and connected with each other to try and and with me. And yes, I was absolutely drawing on what it's like to be up close and personal and to grief and loss, and how it is, okay, it's absolutely devastating, but it also has within it, if you've got the capacity just to go with what's happening, that's what there is. There can be a huge surprise in the center of all of it, with the way in which life can just turn, and you can actually really get an enormous appreciation of everybody around you and of your own life.
And we give a quick mention to the couple of men that are in there as well. Several comedians. Kevin McGahern is in there as well, playing the brother of Kate, and Tom Vaughan Lawler in a lovely role. But let people see where that role brings them. You might finish, I think, Ruth, by telling, because it's at the very end of the movie, you give the dedication, and I think your sister's name is within this. So to whom is the film dedicated?
To my dear little sis, Alico, and my dear friend, Mago.
And all warrior women, I think.
And warrior women everywhere.
That's exactly what it says, warrior women everywhere. Well, thanks a million for speaking to us about the film this evening. That's Ruth Meehan and Anne Gildee.
Thank you, Sean.
Thanks, Anne, and thanks, Ruth. The Bright Side will screen as part of the Cork Film Festival at selected cinemas from next Monday, November the 9th, until Sunday, November the 15th. And that is our lot for this Monday evening here on Arena. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark McGrath was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. I will talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock.